The onrushing hordes of a Tyranid swarm are a terrible sight to behold. Scuttling termagants rub shoulders with deadly gene stealers. Huge carnifexes lumber forward beside tall Tyranid warriors in an avalanche of rattling armored plates, glittering fangs, and gigantic claws. Today's episode brought to you by the Imgarl Tourism Council. This is the War Games Orchard. Welcome to the show. My name is Nathan Stone, and I will be your host today. Today we're going to be looking at the wild early history of the Gene Stealer, one of the most iconic units in Warhammer 40K, and a unit that has spawned incredible fluff, models, and armies over the years. The Gene Stealer's peak is undoubtedly the early era of Warhammer 40K in Rogue Trader and Second Edition, and that's what we will be focusing on today. From their mild beginnings as a random monster in the Rogue Trader rulebook, and continuing on through their appearance in Space Hulk, spawning their own army in the Gene Stealer cults and the Gene Stealer Chaos cults, and finally finding a home within the larger Tyranid army. Before we get into that, let's check in with some hobby news. I've been doing a couple of things lately. What inspired this episode is that I have hit a real rut with my Tyranids. I just can't anymore. You ever get to that point where you're painting your 100th, or in my case, 117th Gaunt or other just cannon fodder troop? And you have a bit of an existential crisis where you look at the models and you're just like, what am I doing with my life right now? Why am I painting these? I hate this. I just wanted to play this army. It was on an impulse. I had the models already. It was so easy to just slap the base coats on them. And now I actually have to paint them. And I'm over 100 models into this army. And I still don't even have 1,000 points. Do you ever have those moments, or is that just me? Because that's where I'm at with my Tyranids right now. I've actually taken a break. One of the reasons I decided to record this episode is because I'm trying to get my Tyranid groove back. I wanted to get excited about the army again, and one of my favorite Tyranid units of all time is the Gene Stealer. And so I started doing some reading on that, and one thing led to another, and here we are doing this episode. But I had to take a break from all of the gaunts that I was painting. It was driving me mad. So I have started in on some Beastmen, and these are the Monopose Hero Hammer era Beastmen. If you cast your mind back, these guys are the ones that have halberds, and they're very big, swole Beastmen. They're very chunky boys, and I love them so much. I've got a test model done up. And by the time you're listening to this, that model will be up on our Warhammer Orchard Facebook group. So you can check that guy out if you want. I'm doing a unit of them so that I can use them in both 40K 2nd Edition and Warhammer Fantasy. I've been really thinking about going back and trying out the 4th Edition Chaos Army book for Fantasy. And the reason is that the 5th Edition book really compartmentalized the way that the three Chaos factions worked. Demons, Chaos Warriors, and Beastmen became quite separated from each other, and I really want to try the 4th edition book, which is a little bit more laissez-faire with it. You can make a really motley Chaos Horde, a big mix of things, and I want to see if I prefer that style a little bit better. Right now, my Beastmen unit is 12 strong, and I'm working through painting them and having a lot of fun with it. Beastmen are a lot of fun to paint. I go with really earthy tones for my Beastmen. Feel like it does them a lot of justice. I did get to play a game recently, and this was a game of 5th edition Warhammer Fantasy. Myself and my buddy Patrick threw down at 1500 points with Orcs versus Skaven, and it had all of the silliness that you would expect from an Orcs versus Skaven game. Unfortunately, all of the silliness was kind of on my side, and it was all to my detriment. A couple of highlights or lowlights of this game for me was I released my Fanatics towards Patrick's battle line. He had three big juicy units that I could go after. And the three fanatics managed to kill two Skaven Plague Monks. And in later turns, one of those fanatics careened back and forth through my units a couple of times, killing seven Black Orcs and a Snotling base, and putting paid to most of my battle plans. I guess I should be thankful he did kill another two Plague Monks at one point, but I still think maybe not the best return on investment from him. Speaking of lack of return on investment, my Orc Warlord charged in to the Skaven Plague Monk unit, and this guy was tooled up. He had seven strength five attacks, and could very easily kill the entire front rank of the Plague Monk unit, which is what I expected him to do. What in fact happened was that he whiffed on all but two of his attacks the first turn, and only killed two Plague Monks, and then lost on combat resolution. Luckily, he passed his leadership check. The second turn, he did the same thing. And I'm not talking about just the same result. I mean, I literally rolled the same exact string of dice, which seems rather improbable. It was a lot of ones and twos, but that is the way it happened. And this time, he did fail his leadership check. His leadership check, which had only been modified down to 9, and the Plague Monks ran him down. That was the end of my army, as three units then broke and fled and ran off the battlefield once the general was dead. Fifth edition is rather harsh when you lose your general. Every unit in your army has to make a leadership test or flee, and I am the worst at leadership tests, as probably evidenced by this story. I lost about 1,000,000 to 2 in that game. This is becoming a real issue for me. I have gotten blown out my last three games, two Warhammer Fantasy games and a second ed 40k game. I've had a real downturn in luck recently. But at least I am getting games in, which does make me luckier than a lot of people, so I won't complain too loudly. That's going to do it for hobby stuff. And in actual news, I do have a few things that I wanted to go over with you guys. Firstly, if you had trouble with the last episode, there is a good reason why. I upload my episodes to Podbean, the podcast host that I use, every Monday night. And they usually release on Tuesday morning. Anyone who didn't use Apple Podcasts won't have noticed this, as every other service but Apple was unaffected. However, Podbean and a few other hosts came under a denial of service attack, and it kept them from uploading the episodes to Apple Podcasts or services that aggregate from Apple Podcasts. What this meant was the episode released about a day later for any users of those services, and it didn't automatically download for everyone. The only reason I was aware that this had happened was because I use Apple Podcasts, and I spent a good part of the day on Tuesday trying to figure out what I had done wrong in uploading the episode, when in fact it was a much, much larger problem. For any of the listeners out there who may have missed that episode because it didn't automatically download, I just wanted to let you know there was an episode last week, and it was on Total War Warhammer. Scott and I had a lovely little chat about that, and it's a lot of fun. So please do listen to that one if it didn't come to you automatically. Next up on my little list is the Warhammer Hall of Fame. If you are a member of our Facebook group, or if you are on any of the Warhammer Facebook fan pages, you may have seen this. I have decided that there needs to be a Warhammer Hall of Fame, and that we would take nominations from the community and let the community decide on a short list of nominees for the Warhammer Hall of Fame. Then next week's episode will be our esteemed Hall of Fame committee debating, discussing, and finally choosing the units and characters that will make the inaugural Warhammer Hall of Fame. It's going to be tons of fun. Please do check us out. I'm going to post it on our podcast page, which is the War Games Orchard Podcast on Facebook. I'm going to be posting that on various groups, our Warhammer Orchard community group, the Hero Hammer community group, Warhammer 6th Edition, Square Hammer, Warhammer the Old World, all of those fan groups. I'm going to put this poll on them. And please jump in with your nominees. We're looking for the most iconic units and characters in Warhammer history. And we're going to have a lot of fun narrowing down a list of finalists and then finally coming up with our picks for the very first War Games Orchard Warhammer Hall of Fame. That's going to be lots of fun. The final news item is my obligatory Patreon plug. The War Games Orchard Patreon page hosts all of our bonus content. We do one bonus episode a month, plus whatever ideas pop into my head, including stories. And as we move into March, there's going to be some video on there as well. Our Patreon is completely non-tiered. There is no paywall beyond making whatever donation you see fit. So for as little as a dollar, you can get a bonus episode every month, plus stories, and a whole host of other things coming very soon. Our February episode is The Legend of Dimzad and Ludo, where Scott and I sat down and made 100% randomized Warhammer Fantasy first edition roleplay characters. That episode is a ton of fun. Our March episode is going to be a companion piece to the upcoming Warhammer Hall of Fame. It is going to be the Warhammer Hall of Shame, where we will be bringing you the worst of the worst units and characters from the history of Warhammer Fantasy. I don't think you're going to want to miss that one, and we do hugely appreciate any donation at all. It helps pay for the hosting of this podcast and just makes us feel really, really good. So if you're able to, please check that out. Now let's get into things. I haven't done a lot of 40K on the War Games Orchard podcast, and that's for a couple of reasons. The first reason is I am primarily a Warhammer Fantasy fan. I love 40K, but not to the same extent that I love Warhammer Fantasy. The second reason is that Warhammer 40K is big. It's really, really big. And a lot of my bread and butter on this podcast is looking at units and characters and how they change and evolve through the eras of the game. And for 40K, that becomes a much harder task than fantasy. At least it does while trying to keep the episodes under 2 hours. The last full 40K episode that we did on World Eaters was a bit of a slog for me. And even ignoring the technical difficulties, it was a whole lot of work. More so than is practical for a weekly podcast. Another issue is that content for Warhammer 40K is quite plentiful. There is a lot of really good people making a lot of really good stuff on Warhammer 40K, and I don't want to just do what other people are doing. That's not what we're about here. If I'm going to create content for 40K, it's going to have to be different than what everyone else is doing, because otherwise, what is the point? And the last variable is that you guys, the audience, seem to be of two minds on the 40K content. I have gotten several comments asking me both to cover more 40K subjects and to cut out the 40K entirely. And I'm really not sure how to deal with that. I've come up with a plan for 40K content on this show. And that is, we're going to lean into the early eras more so than the later eras. And the reason why is that there's about 1,000 40K podcasts for the current era of 40K. If you want 9th edition stuff, you've got a million places to go. But I think the real heart of 40K, the real feel of it, was set down in that early era. Rogue Trader, 2nd edition, and that transitory period between 2nd and 3rd. So that's where we're going to try and live with this episode, and likely episodes going forward. I can't promise you that this is the way that it's going to stay. We might have to rethink our 40K episodes again, but we're going to give this one a shot, and I would love to hear your feedback on what you think. Now let's jump into things properly. The Gene Stealer is an absolute classic from Warhammer 40K. In fact, if we were doing our Warhammer Hall of Fame for 40K, which we probably will in the future, Gene Stealers would be one that I would nominate. They are one of the most important alien creatures in the game, and they've been here since the very beginning. Usually when I do these podcasts, I'll go into the history first and then look at the unit, But we're going to switch things up a little bit this time. Because the lore of the Gene Stealer changes so much when it evolves, which is quite fitting when you think about it. But for our first stop, we're going to go all the way back to the very first edition of Warhammer 40,000, the Rogue Trader Rulebook. You'll find Gene Stealers in this book alongside a ton of other incredible aliens and creatures. There's so much here to look at, from the Amble to the Enslavers to carnivorous sand clams, Catechin devils, dinosaurs. Yep, just straight up dinosaurs. And my personal favorite, Terra Squirrels. Terra Squirrels being giant blood-drinking flying squirrels. They're incredible. Just reading through the monster section of this book has given me an idea for a Fantastic Beasts of Warhammer 40,000 episode, so please stay tuned to that because I don't think I can resist doing at least half an hour on the Terra Squirrel alone. For now, though, we're just going to go with the Gene Stealer. This is where we get our first picture of the Gene Stealer and what it looks like, and what we get here is kind of like a leech mixed with a velociraptor with four arms. That's the best way I can describe it. Besides the four arms, it doesn't have a lot in common with the Stealers that we have known. Although this picture of the Gene Stealer is really the only time that we're going to see a significant difference in the Gene Stealer's look from that very classic look that we all know. Let's take a look at its original entry. This enigmatic monster originates from one of the moons of Imgarl, but has spread throughout space and is threatening to become a real menace. In its native state, it is blue, has two pairs of clawed arms, a long muscular tail, and a tough leech-like body. Its head is a simple tube full of slobbering tendrils and sharp, inward-pointing teeth. What makes the Gene Stealer truly unique is its deadly and extremely rapid reproduction cycle. Gene Stealers are of a single gender, and they are incapable of reproducing amongst themselves. To reproduce, they require another creature. Any creature will suffice, of any gender. For all the Gene Stealer requires is the basic genetic material, which is contained in every living cell of the mate. A Gene Stealer implants its own genetic material in the form of an egg capsule, which is forced into the body of the host by an extendable ovipository, normally secreted inside the head. The implantation does not kill the mate immediately, but the implanted egg quickly grows until ready to burst out as an immature Gene Stealer. Needless to say, this kills the parent/host. Interestingly enough, newly born creatures, although fundamentally Gene Stealers, will have characteristics inherited from the host parent. Thus, a Gene Stealer/human may have a vaguely humanoid head, or only two arms instead of the usual four, and perhaps its tail will be shortened or missing. A Gene Stealer of four or more generations' consistent human parentage would pass for a human on cursory inspection, although a closer look would reveal a bluish skin, sharp pointed teeth, and a rather disturbing stare. On their homeworld, Gene Stealers exploit a large leech-like creature called a Sith, which is its usual mate. Matings with a Sith always produce a natural Gene Stealer, no matter what its parentage otherwise. We have a lot of the basis of what would become the later Gene Stealers here, and this is long before they become a Tyranid vanguard organism. In fact, Tyranids do show up elsewhere in this Rogue Trader book, and they are in a very different state from what they would become, as are Gene Stealers. We get a strong alien vibe with the early Gene Stealers. Instead of facehuggers, we have the ovipositor, which lays the egg in the host. We do have the Gene Stealer bursting out of the host, like the classic chest burster. We also have the alien trope where they do take on some genetic similarities with their host. Our OG Gene Stealer has some very impressive stats, even in this early era. He has a movement of 6, a weapon skill of 6, no ballistic skill, strength of 5, toughness of 4, 2 wounds, initiative 5, 2 attacks, leadership 10, intelligence 3, cool 3, and willpower 8. And our book does specify that this is a pure Imgarl gene stealer. So this is no human parentage, which is why its intelligence is so low. And our entry goes on to state that gene stealers with different parentages will have differing stats. Gene stealers also have a special rule that when they land a blow in close combat, they can implant an egg capsule instead of doing damage, and the egg will hatch in any subsequent turn on a d6 roll of a 6. When that gene stealer hatches, it will of course kill the host. And the immature gene stealers are interesting because it seems that they have the stats of the fully grown gene stealers, but they are incapable of breeding. And a gene stealer matures only once it has killed and eaten 3 human-sized creatures. And this is my favorite part, it makes sure in parentheses to tell us that it takes 1 full turn to eat a human-sized creature. That's a little terrifying considering gene stealers are human-sized creatures. It is possible in a game that you could have a gene stealer implant a host, the host to birth the baby gene stealer, and then the gene stealer able to eat enough other humans or human-sized creatures to mature. It's pretty fantastic. Another important thing to remember from this era of gene stealers, as we saw in the description, is that they can mate with just about anything. And this leads to an interesting final note about gene stealers in games. They lend themselves to all sorts of interesting situations. Their vampirish habits can be exploited to enact games with vampiric plots, in which, for example, a human-slash-gene-stealer lordling is being attacked in his castle by outraged peasants supported by an inquisitor and imperial troops. The gene-stealer has a few of his offspring to help defend his home, perhaps including a few curious crossbreeds such as wolf gene-stealers, razor-wing gene-stealers, etc. Remember, gene-stealers are not necessarily evil or stupid. Cross-humans will have many human traits, may socialize with humans, and may even help humans in some circumstances. There is a chance of gene stealers developing psychic powers if they are crossed with normally psychic races. A pure gene stealer has a 0% chance of developing psychic powers, but in creatures of mixed parentage, the chance is an average of their parents. That is really neat. The thing to remember, if this sounds utterly crazy to you, is that Rogue Trader has a lot more in common with a role-playing game than it does with our 9th edition era that is purely tabletop. Games Workshop writing this assumed that you had a game master to control the ebb and flow of your game, and that almost all play was going to be various scenario play. I love the idea of a gene stealer in a castle, like a vampire or like a mad scientist, and his castle's besieged by peasants and a single inquisitor. It's just a very cool idea. It's that beautiful space fantasy that Warhammer 40,000 lends itself to so well. Gene stealers needed to change a whole lot to become the creatures we know them as today. And in 1989, Games Workshop released a game that would change gene stealers, and in some ways, Space Marines, in perpetuity. That was the first edition of Space Hulk. Games Workshop's looking for an enemy for the Terminators in Space Hulk, and gene stealers having that vibe of the classic Alien movie fit so well for the claustrophobic environs of a Space Hulk game. This game really changed the look and the feel of gene stealers going forward. They lost that leech-like look, and they became somewhat more human-looking as well. Their second pair of arms started ending in fingers instead of just purely claws. Their head looked more humanoid, and their lore really started to develop. That first edition of Space Hulk received 2 supplements. The first one was Deathwing, that was released in 1990, but the second one was called Gene Stealer, which was also released just a little bit later in 1990. And it introduced the Gene Stealer cult to Space Hulk games, and we're going to talk a lot about Gene Stealer cults, because that's where the lore gets a little nuts, and there's some incredibly cool things that only really appear in Rogue Trader around Gene Stealer cults. But this supplement introduced human gene stealer hybrids, the Magus, and the Patriarch into the game. And it is in this 1990-91 era where gene stealers really start to come into their own. I have to make a little bit of a confession to you guys at this point in the episode. I've never really liked Space Hulk. I don't know why. I've played both the second edition and the third edition. And for whatever reason, it's just not for me. It just doesn't seem to speak to me as a Warhammer game, and that's really rare. But I know the game has had quite a fan base, and it has given us some incredible miniatures and scenarios over the years, and I do love the idea of it. I'm mildly claustrophobic myself, not terribly, just mildly. And the idea of walking down these cramped Space Hulk corridors, and you're in big bulky Terminator armor, and there's all these things, and they're in the walls, man. It's just a very cool setting, and I really wish I enjoyed those games a little bit more. Space Hulk was the catalyst for everything that the Gene Stealers would become. And Games Workshop wasted no time in putting these new and improved Gene Stealers back into Rogue Trader. In 1991, we received the Warhammer 40,000 compilation. This compilation focused on adding things to the game for the Imperial factions, the Eldar factions, and in a big way, the Gene Stealers. The Gene Stealers, still not tied to the Tyranids in any way by this point, got a ton from this compilation, and it was all things that had their genesis within Space Hulk. It's really hard to overstate the importance that Space Hulk played in fleshing out the Gene Stealer. In this release, they receive not only a huge lore update, but two army lists, the Gene Stealer Invasion Force and the Gene Stealer Cult Army. The Gene Stealer Invasion Force is far more similar to what we think of today as the Gene Stealer Cult. The Gene Stealer Cult is a wild ride. It is a chaos-worshipping Gene Stealer cult, and oh my goodness, is it fun and full of awesome stuff. We're going to start things off by looking at what a few years of development can do to the lore. Let's explore how this Warhammer compilation now describes Gene Stealers and contrast it to our original description. The Gene Stealers are a race of aliens from another galaxy who seek to conquer the Imperium from within. They infiltrate a planet, infecting citizens with their genetic material and causing their children to be born Gene Stealer human hybrids. A Stealer and its victim form a secret cult on the planet, wherein the Stealer's monstrous progeny can mature in safety and secrecy until they are in a position to challenge the planet's rulers. These cults seek to gain control over the host planet subtly, through hidden manipulation of the populace and subversion of the planetary government. However, they can put a potent force into battle if threatened. The Stealer cults sometimes form alliances with other cults, and they can be found fighting along chaos or vampire cults or warbands, or, if it suits their purpose, against them. The Gene Stealers are amongst the most unusual creatures humanity has yet encountered, combining extraordinary intelligence and subtlety of the mind with remarkable strength and quickness of the body. Their torsos and extremities are protected by a deep blue carapace. Their sinewy muscles are purple-red. They are bipedal, standing in a perpetual crouch atop hooved feet. And they have two sets of arms, one equipped with human-like hands, and one with powerful rippling claws. The Gene Stealers' hairless heads are bulbous in shape, colored the same deep purple-red as their muscles, with the creature's fang-filled mouths and hypnotic eyes at the front. Gene Stealers are stronger and hardier than men, able to withstand even the most hostile environments, including a hard vacuum, unprotected. They can live for centuries. What a difference a few years can make in the lore of a species in Warhammer. This is a really incredible change, and a lot of it is the change to the look and the feel of the Gene Stealer itself. We're talking about a bulbous head as opposed to a leech-like head. Their intelligence has gotten a huge bump. And for the first time, we get the idea that this is an organized force that is fighting against humanity, that seeks to corrupt and take over humanity through creating these hybrids and basically foistering their genetic material upon the humans of the Imperium. There's so much more here to the Gene Stealers than their original version, and they're really only lacking that Tyranid part of their lore to be complete. This book goes on to flesh out so much of the Gene Stealers in terms of reproduction and their stance on technology. And I like this in the technology section. Though equipped with flexible, sensitive hands, pure strain Gene Stealers are mentally incapable of using even the simplest tools and weapons. Apparently, the very concept of manipulating their environment through tools is entirely alien to their psychology, and they are not able to comprehend the workings of the lever, the spear, or the blaster. This is extremely fortunate for the Imperium, for in every other way, they are deadly warriors. It goes on to say that their hybrids don't share this same problem. The reproduction cycle of the Gene Stealer has changed a lot since the early Rogue Trader days as well. We remember the basic chestburster element of the Gene Stealer. It has gone in favor of the new mind control method, wherein the Gene Stealer still uses its ovipositor to infect or otherwise stab its seed into a host. In the new lore, that host doesn't act as a surrogate for a Gene Stealer baby. Instead, the host is subject to a type of telepathic mind control, and the host's offspring will start that chain of hybrids. So a big change there. There are some positives, if you want to stretch the term, to being infected or impregnated by a Gene Stealer, and one of those is that the Stealer's DNA kind of gets into your system, and you gain some of the Gene Stealer's remarkable strength and resilience, as well as having your lifespan extended. You're also far less prone to getting sick. All of these things are biologically programmed to make you a better mate and increase your chances of mating, and thus passing on the Gene Stealer's, well, genes. It's a really interesting system. And it should be noted that in the Rogue Trader era, though humans are of course the most common of the Stealer's targets, we did get rules for Orc Gene Stealer hybrids, and they're very interesting indeed. Now let's touch on the Gene Stealer cults themselves. There are many cults scattered throughout the Imperium in an age where psychic power is strong. When demons and monsters stalk the galaxy, and the powers that be ruthlessly suppress all knowledge of these things, it is inevitable that the foolish, the curious, or the power-hungry will seek out this knowledge on their own. Such people often form religions, secret societies, or hidden enclaves where they can experiment, plot, or worship far from the prying eyes of the Inquisition. Some of these cults are harmless, run by religious quacks or charlatans. Some are much more sinister. It is rumored that there are millions of Chaos cults scattered throughout the Imperium, as well as other groups dedicated to the Emperor's downfall, including Gene Stealer cults. When they arrive on a human planet, the Gene Stealer and its human thrall go as far away as possible from civilization, settling in the most remote and desolate part of the planet, either in the far wilderness or the deep bowels of the abandoned inner city. The Gene Stealer begins to prey on the humans around him. Those he infects join his cult. The children of the infected humans, the Human Stealer hybrids, are kept well hidden from prying eyes. A Gene Stealer cult usually masquerades as a new religion, with the Stealer's thrall as its titular head. In outward appearance, the religion is completely harmless, and often laudable, promoting hard work, cherishing the young, and respecting the old, and encouraging extreme modesty. Most of the priests and priestesses go about completely robed at all times. The religious message is simple, usually foretelling the coming arrival of the blessed children who will lead their parents to eternal bliss. As it grows in power and influence, the religion attracts genuine converts who have no idea of the sinister cult hiding behind it. Eventually, these dupes are initiated into the deeper mysteries of the faith and infected themselves. Though Gene Stealers are driven by a ferocious and all but uncontrollable need to infect victims to ensure the survival of their species, the pure Stealer restrains itself and its progeny from infecting too many humans too fast. recognizing that the religion's too rapid growth might arouse suspicion of the Imperial Inquisition. The years pass, and eventually the third and fourth generation hybrids are born. Some are virtually indistinguishable from untainted humans. It is at this point that the titular head of the religion, the original crew member infected by the Stealer, is removed, and his place is taken by a fourth generation hybrid. The hybrid, having some of the Gene Stealer's hypnotic powers, literally mesmerizes those who see him, gaining new and even more fanatical members of the cult. Other fourth generation hybrids leave the close protection of the cult, and masquerading as diplomats, religious missionaries, merchants, or other travelers, spread the infection across the planet and throughout the Imperium. Once the fourth generation is born, virtually the only way to stop the infection is to sterilize the entire planet, killing every living thing on it. Gene Stealer cults are wonderfully nefarious in their modes and methods. To create these cults, I feel like Games Workshop took a look at a lot of examples of modern-day cults that had sprung up in the Western world and took some of their modus operandi from them. Now that we know a little bit about the cults and the Gene Stealers of this era, let's look at the first army list in this book, and that is the Gene Stealer Invasion Force. This force is your classic cult, and you're going to recognize some things if you are familiar with the Gene Stealer cults of 7th edition onward. The first thing we have is a patriarch. And the patriarch is always the oldest and most venerated pure strain Gene Stealer in the force. It is the original source of the infection. And when a Gene Stealer becomes a patriarch, as it grows a cult around it, it will grow physically larger and psychically more powerful. It becomes the center of the cult, kind of the way that the Emperor is the center of the Imperium. The patriarch fulfills the same purpose, but on a much smaller scale. In these early days, your force must be led by a patriarch. And actually, as we'll see, that kind of continues into second edition as well. You would then choose your hybrids as well as your pure strains. And in this era, you would buy them by generation. And what's really neat about these is each one has its own picture showing you the level of hybridization in each of these generations. The first one it shows us is the third gen. These guys, quite physically powerful, they have stats that are about on par with the Space Marine of the era, with a weapon skill 4 and a strength 4. And what's neat about them is you can roll to see things like how many arms do they have, and do they have ovipositors. They also have some really cool abilities like hypnotic gaze and brood telepathy that gives them some advantage in battle. We also have fourth generation hybrids. These guys are the ones that look very human-like, but very angular features. You can still see a bit of the Stealer in them. These guys have very similar stats to the third gens. They're still stronger than your average human is because of that Stealer lineage, but they don't get a sweet random limbs table, which is a little unfortunate. I wish more things had a random limbs table. I'd love to roll for random limbs before all my games. I probably shouldn't want that, because that's how I end up with Chaos Warriors that have to roll into battle. Next up is the Pure Strain Gene Stealers. Of course, if you're taking a Gene Stealer cult list, you need some actual regular old Gene Stealers. Gene Stealers are terrifying. So we went through their profile for their very first incarnation in Rogue Trader, where they were very leech-like, and they weren't out to topple the Imperium. But now that they've got it all together, and have become their own army and their own race, and they are important, they've got a bit of a bump, and oh boy, they do not play around. Let's go over their stats and see if you like these bad boys. Movement of 6, weapon skill 7, ballistic skill 0, strength 6, toughness 4, 2 wounds, initiative 7, 4 attacks, leadership 10, intelligence 7, cool 10, and willpower 8. If you're a regular listener to this podcast, you'll know those last three stats, intelligence, cool, and willpower. Those are for the more roleplay aspects of this game, and they would go away with the advent of second edition. For now, what you'd need to know is intelligence is a basic measure of how smart a unit is. Cool is how good they are under pressure, And willpower was used a lot in trying to resist psychic powers. Kind of a very early days Deny the Witch for anyone of the modern era. And this stat block is pretty incredible. I would love to see Gene Stealers with this stat block today. I know it'll never happen. But 2 wounds, 4 attacks, strength 6. They could tear a space marine limb from limb and not break a sweat. This army list is quite small, because there just wasn't a huge amount of available models at the time. And it's also full of charts, because as anyone knows, when you're playing in a role-playing game, or kind of a hybrid role-playing game as Rogue Trader was, the more random charts you can put into your game, the better that game is. And Games Workshop, let me tell you, they could put random charts in things. So we have a lot of that. You can roll for pretty much anything, including their weapons and their equipment, all sorts of things. We also have a few chaos options here. In case your Gene Stealer Invasion Force started out as a chaos cult. But we're not going to get into those there, because trust me when I say we're going to get into it in a couple minutes, and it is something else. It's really, really cool. One thing that you could do when you were building your Gene Stealer cult or Gene Stealer Invasion Force is determine their homeworld. And this is another one of those very role-play type of elements in the game at this time. It was very simple. You would roll a d6, and on 1 or 2, you would be from a medieval or feral world. On a 3 to 4, you would be from a frontier world. Or on a 5 to 6, you would be from a developed world. And what this did was it limited your available technology and equipment to a certain point. Of course, the feral and medieval worlds were the most technologically limited, and on the opposite end of the scale, the developed world would have the things that you would most commonly associate with 40k equipment. And this mattered for a lot of things, but it really mattered for transports. This is an army that doesn't have a lot in the way of tanks. This is before the whole Brood Brothers thing. You weren't just stealing an average Lehman Russ, though you could travel in style. And here we come to the famous cult limousines. The cult limousines are incredible. Of all the things that they did in the 7th edition reboot of the Gene Stealer cults, the fact that they traded their classy limousines for these mining vehicles is still, in my eyes, an unforgivable sin. Limousines were comical, but they also spoke to the very cult nature of the way that the Gene Stealers operate. And this goes back to what I said earlier about Games Workshop looking at real-world cults and incidents and working some of this stuff into the fluff. In some of these early stories about Gene Stealer cults, the Gene Stealer Patriarch just rides around in this limo and just waits in the limo as battles or skirmishes are going on and controls his brood, but nobody sees him. He's this rock star inside of his limo, and all of the infected humans and worshippers that he has think of him as this aloof, nearly supernatural presence, who they can just kind of see as a silhouette through the limousine door. There's something about that that I just love so much. It's a wonderful, silly, funny piece of history, and I'm super sad that it's gone away. And this is what the compilation has to say on limousines. Even on quite backward frontier worlds, powerful individuals can usually acquire armored limousines. These vehicles are usually customized civilian city cars or road wheelers, and are able to carry 6 occupants, including the driver. The Coven has enough limousines to carry all of its members, armed with any surplus equipment from the army itself. To represent the Coven limousines on the battlefield, you can use the 1/43rd scale die-cast metal car models that are readily available in any toy or model shop. You can tell how old this book is by the fact that they're not telling you to buy the Citadel trademark kits and cut them apart and build your own limousine for only the cost of 4 tanks. Now let's look at the Gene Stealer cult army list. I've browsed through a lot of army lists for this podcast, and I love the way that early Games Workshop operated, because they weren't super concerned about balance or anything like that. They really just wanted to make things that would do something neat on the tabletop. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad, but it was always interesting. That's what you get with these early editions. They're always interesting. And this might be the most interesting list I have come across, because it starts out pretty crazy and it just keeps going from there. You have all of the oddness of Gene Stealers combined with all of the random crazy that is chaos of this era, and it gels together to make something kind of beautiful. Firstly, we start off with the Gene Stealer patriarch as Oracle. This is a patriarch who has made a deal with the gods of chaos for additional power. In payment, he and his followers now worship the dark gods. And instead of being a messiah figure, as the regular Gene Stealer patriarchs are to their worshippers, this patriarch is seen more of an oracle, he who speaks the words of the god, as opposed to a godlike figure himself. And the Gene Stealer patriarch is so interesting, and he has the same profile as a regular Gene Stealer. The patriarchs of this era weren't necessarily stronger or tougher in base stats, but they had a lot of upgrades that would make them more than the sum of their parts. This Gene Stealer, he's got maybe the greatest random chart of all time. And to get access to this, what you want to do is make your Gene Stealer patriarch demonically possessed. And if you're playing as Gene Stealers worshipping chaos gods, I mean, why not? Well, there's some reasons why not, but it's just so cool that I think if I were to ever play this, and I'm never going to play this, but if I was, I would do this 100% of the time. Now, for a scant 500 points, you will barely even notice you spent the points on it. You can make your Gene Stealer Patriarch possessed. And what does that do? Well, it might do a lot of things. The first and most notable thing that it does is it changes his profile up. And it's not a flat buff. In fact, there are so many options here. Because you don't know what kind of demon is going to come in and possess your patriarch. And the patriarch's stat line changes to be an amalgam of his stat line and the demon who is possessing him, which can be really good. But you don't have any control over that. What you will do is choose a patron god, or you can go for independent demons, then roll a d12. So, for example, perhaps you choose Khorne, always a popular choice, and you roll a 1. This means that you were possessed by a bloodthirster. Congratulations. The bloodthirster gives him a point of weapon skill, 5 points of ballistic skill, a point of toughness, 4 more wounds, a point of initiative, 3 extra attacks, and a point of willpower, giving him a ridiculous stat line with 7 attacks at strength 6, weapon skill 8, and initiative 8. And that is pretty great. Is it worth 500 points? I have no idea. Much like whose line is it anyway, I am willing to bet that everything's made up and the points don't matter. What's interesting, though, is that you are not going to roll a bloodthirster every time. You might roll a lesser demon. And if you roll a lesser demon, sometimes you can lose stats. If a bloodletter possesses your patriarch, you will lose a movement down to 5. You will lose a strength, a toughness, a wound, an initiative, an attack, and that is unfortunate. But even with this profile, he can still do some damage. That loss of a wound is really painful. But my friends, it can get worse. Perhaps you're a follower of Nurgle. Everyone likes Nurgle, he's very friendly, and he would love to have you as his follower. And you would scroll through this chart and you would see the Great Unclean One mixed with the Patriarch. Ooh, that's a good looking profile there. But then you would roll, and maybe you roll 11, in which case your Gene Stealer Patriarch is possessed by a Nurgling. And this is one of the worst things that I think could happen to you, as you will lose 1 point of movement, 3 points of weapon skill, 3 strength, 2 toughness, 2 points of initiative, an attack, 3 points of leadership, 1 point of intelligence, two cool, and one willpower. Do you want the leader of your army to have strength 3, toughness 2? Because we can make that happen for you for the low, low price of 500 points. Go from weapon skill 7, strength 6 with 4 attacks to weapon skill 4, strength 3 with 3 attacks. And a big old toughness of 2. It is silly, but it is still a very fun chart to roll on. And you can be possessed by all sorts of weird stuff here. A Disc of Tzeentch can possess your Gene Stealer Patriarch, as can a Mount of Slaanesh. If you want your Gene Stealer Patriarch to go from Intelligence 7 to Intelligence 3, that's how you do that. This is such an incredible option for a character. It is really, really neat. The rest of this army isn't any less cool. This is where we see the Gene Stealer Magus show up. He's a 4th generation hybrid, which you would expect because he looks mostly human. And he has the hybrid profile, which is the slightly above human standard. And of course, his big thing is you can buy psychic powers for him. One of his options, though, is a demon weapon for the low, low cost of 500 points again. So if you want to run a very small force in Rogue Trader, I think this is the force you might want to do it with. Will it be good or at all playable? Probably not. But hey, you will get those models on the field. Next up is the Gene Stealer Initiates. These guys are the pure strains, except that if you look at their picture, they have definitely felt the touch of chaos. One of them has spikes growing out of his head. The other one's head is just kind of unfortunate. What's neat about them is they have the normal Stealer profile, but then they also get chaos attributes. They get D6 minus 2 of them. So you might get none, but you might get a few. Then there are the Hybrid Initiates. So unlike the Gene Stealer Invasion Force, these Hybrid Initiates are a mix of the generations. And for this unit, you don't actually know what you're getting. You buy them, and then you roll a D6 to see which of the generations you end up with. And you can get anything from some first generations, who are very similar to the Gene Stealers in stats, which means they are close combat monsters, to the fourth generation, which are much more human and actually have an okay ballistic skill, so you could give them guns. It is going to be a very random unit. And this is where our roll for arms charts come back, which is really nice, and we get a breakdown for each generation and how likely they are to have certain numbers of limbs. And my god, is that fun. Like, I don't think I've ever had as much fun making a list as anyone in Rogue Trader playing with this book. Next up, we see our limousine profile, and this is one of the coolest looking things. It looks almost like a hover limousine with two assault cannons coming out of either end of the front spoiler. It's got a hybrid muscle car slash London taxi look with an incredible eagle hood ornament. This is one of the coolest illustrations in the book, and I'm a little furious that not only did we never get these in the Rogue Trader era, we still don't have these today. Instead, we have the derpy rock grinder, who is lame and nobody likes. Apologies if you like the rock grinder. All I see is lost possibilities for limousines every time I look at the thing. Now we look at some of the more human options and chaotic options in this list. The first is the Rogue Psykers. And their fluff is basically that the Gene Stealers will seek out those with the psychic gift to try and implant because they are so useful to the cause. And these models represent those individuals that are fully human but have been implanted by the Gene Stealers. Then we get our first Brood Brothers. And the Brood Brothers are really neat. They are described as the human parents and siblings of the hybrids in the coven. So these are just basic humans. They have the basic human stat line, mostly threes across the board. And you had to take them in the sacred numbers of the Chaos Powers, because, again, everyone, as well as kind of worshipping the Patriarch, is still a follower of Chaos. And the picture that we get of these Brood Brothers is some Imperial Guardsmen with cornate runes all over their armor. If your Brood Brothers are devoted to Khorne, you are looking at 8 models per unit, Slaanesh 6, Nurgle 7, and Tzeentch 9. Or if they worship Chaos Undivided, you can take 10, and the cost varies depending on how many of them are in the unit. They get Chaos attributes as well, but it's much more unlikely at a d6 minus 4. And their basic equipment depends on the world role that you did at the start of creating this army. So if they're from a medieval or feral world, you're looking at hand weapons, shield, double hand weapons. Basically, you're looking at equipping them as if they were playing fantasy. In a frontier world, they can have those fantasy weapons, or up to half of them can have some basic guns, stub guns, las pistols, or las guns. And on a developed world, they all get stub guns as well as swords. This is already one of the coolest armies I have ever seen. And it just gets cooler from here, because anytime you bring beastmen into things, it just gets better. And you can take beastmen in this army. Think of this. You can have Gene Stealers, Imperial Guardsmen, and Beastmen all in the same army. Man, early 40k was so cool. I just can't get over this. The Beastmen are what you'd expect. Mostly human stats, better weapon skill, and better toughness. They can also get Chaos attributes up to d6 minus 4. And their fluff is kind of interesting. Once a Gene Stealer cult army has decided to march on its enemies, it will call up allies from the surrounding area. One such group of allies are the Beastmen. Like the cult members themselves, they quickly become prey to the will of the Magus, who will exploit the animal aggression to the full. This is kind of neat because it sounds like the Gene Stealer cults prey on the fact that the Beastmen are both castouts from human society and naturally prone to being Chaos worshippers, and manipulate them to their own ends. For the Beastmen, you also buy them in the sacred numbers of their gods, as you do for the next unit coming up, which is the Mutants. The Mutants are the Brood Brothers who have started to degenerate under the weight of the gifts of the Chaos Gods, and they seem like a bit of a cannon fodder unit. They are quite cheap. They aren't armed with much, but you can give them explosive collars and run them into the enemy and detonate an interesting chaff unit that the enemy can't ignore. And if you can't get enough of your models blowing themselves up, why not cut out the middleman and just take some mutant bombs, which are our next entry. These guys are exactly what you think. They are mutant suicide bombers. They are the Brood Brothers, which the Magus or the Patriarch has tricked into wearing giant explosive collars by telling them that a great afterlife awaits them, and they like to run into the enemy and blow up. Both these guys and the mutant bands get up to D6 Chaos attributes, which makes sense as they are more mutated than most of their counterparts. And if you just can't get enough Chaos goodness in your Gene Stealer cult, why not summon some demons? You can have up to D6 summon demons. And it's possible to get basically any type of demon that existed at the time, which is honestly most of them, and they all have their own points cost associated with them. If you need a friend for your rogue Saiger or your Magus, you can get demonic familiars, and they're free, which is pretty cool. However, you do have to randomly determine which one you get, because of course you do. Other interesting tidbits is that you can get Chaos Spawn in this army, and that makes sense because eventually your mutants or your Brood Brothers are going to degenerate to the point where they become Chaos Spawn. And you can buy horses. That's right, you buy horses, and then you can separately mount Brood Brothers squads on horses if you want some Rough Riders in your Chaos Cult. Now we have Gene Stealers, Rough Riders, Chaos Demons, and Beastmen in this army. And I'm sorry, folks, this is just the best army list that has ever been created. And now you might be thinking, well, I don't have enough limousines to get all of these guys where they need to go, even if I put some of them on horses. Well, this army list has you covered. There is a whole world of civilian vehicles for you to use in this army. You can buy a motorcycle, a bike, and a sidecar if you want to play Space Marine Attack Bike. You can buy a trike, a jet bike, a city car. They don't tell me which brand of city car. We're going to say like a Toyota, a road wheeler, or a tracked vehicle. So add to all of the wackiness of this list just a bunch of minivans and sedans transporting your cult into battle. This list is so good. That is all for the list, unfortunately, and I just don't know how they could make it any better, so they may as well have stopped there. The book gives you all sorts of options for developing your cult as well. It's all very thematic, very lore-friendly, and this is the kind of flavor that really doesn't exist in 40K anymore, unfortunately. And I know a lot of it is because of balance issues, because of streamlining, keeping your toys separate from one another. And this list isn't big, it's maybe 4 or 5 pages, but when you read it, it will just overcome you with the possibilities, the modeling options, the ideas that'll flow through your head of this ragtag army that you just can't play in 40K today. And I know Gene Stealers are supposed to be that, mutated civilians, but they just look so uniform now. And they've lost the silly, they've lost the fun. There's none of this chaos stuff. It all just ties into the Tyranids, and I love Tyranids, they're good. But it's just kind of sad to see when you have an era with so much going on, and then over the years it just loses more and more of that flavor. It's not all doom and gloom, though, as Games Workshop has started, more so in the 8th and 9th eras, going back into those wells of the early days to draw some of that up. I don't think Gene Stealer cults are ever going to be what they were, but we have started to get some of this stuff from the early days, so maybe in a few years we'll see Codex Chaos Gene Stealer cults, and I will be the happiest man on Earth. Before we leave the compilation book, I'm just going to share with you a very short vignette here, and I think it illustrates the flavor of these early day Gene Stealer cults quite well. The cavern was packed. A huge crowd of creatures had gathered to hear the Magus talk of conquest, rebellion, and bloodletting. Carol raised his arms and silence descended on the room, broken only by the snapping of twigs that twisted and blackened in huge braziers. Standing at his side were the initiates of the cult, waiting for him to tell the broodkin what they must do.
"Brothers and sisters, most of you know why we have called you to this place. For those that don't know, look around you. Now is the time. We must seize power from those too blind to welcome us into their society. 4 generations have passed since."
Carol turned to look at the patriarch, giving him a broad smile.
"Since enlightenment arrived, and we are finally ready to..."
The speech was interrupted by a creak from the back of the hall. The oak-clad doors swung wide, the hinges protesting as the huge weighted panels moved apart. A band of deformed creatures stood in the doorway.
"Our allies have arrived, my friends,"
said Carl, nodding with approval.
"They have come from the forest to join us. Our master Khorne summoned them to aid us. He gifts us with their presence."
The beastmen shuffled into the room, pushing their way through the crowd towards the front. They stunk of dark places in the forest, and their weapons were encrusted with dried blood. Yet they were welcomed into this family like brothers, for each bore the skull rune branded onto his skin.
"We hear. We come. We help. Yes? We kill people who hurt us, and say we different. Sent us into forest. Now we come back. Spill much blood of those who punish us."
A murmur of approval spread through the crowd. The beastmen would be valuable to their cause, and require little payment, wishing only to feast on the bodies of the fallen. The beastmen moved towards Carl. Once there, they stood quietly at his feet, grunting occasionally as he continued.
"We leave when dusk falls, and move towards the city under cover of darkness."
His voice fell to a whisper.
"Those who have not yet joined us in blessed worship have lost their chance. At first light tomorrow, the blood of our oppressors will run in the streets."
How cool was that, huh? It was pretty cool. I'm very excited about all this. I don't know why. I'm never going to play this army. I'm probably never going to play Rogue Trader. But just reading this has me filled with various cool ideas for silly themed armies.
We're just about done in Rogue Trader today. But before we go, we're going to look at one last thing that I would be remiss if I didn't include in this overview. And that is Orc Gene Stealer Hybrids. In the great supplement Freebooters, Orc Gene Stealer Hybrids are described. And like most things with the orcs, they are pretty comical. Instead of being their own army, they're kind of a strange unit made up of all sorts of different generations of orc hybrids and the patriarch itself. And we won't get into their stats today, but I did want to share their lore as it appears here because it's pretty funny, and it's a neat part of both the early orc and early gene stealer lore. Orcs are not an ideal host race for gene stealers, and eventually any gene stealers who infect them will realize that orcs are a dead end as far as their prospects for furthering the gene stealer species is concerned. Orc society is not structured like human society, and the sophisticated techniques of infiltration around a secure power base will not necessarily work. Sometimes gene stealers find that they must infect orcs simply because no better hosts are available. Orcs find and board drifting space hulks and delve into deserted ruins, which are exactly the sorts of places where gene stealers might lurk. If the gene stealer has been waiting for centuries to infect a host, and a party of orcs just happen to turn up, the gene stealer will simply follow their instinct to procreate their race. They are just unlucky it was orcs. Sometimes, albeit rarely, a gene stealer orc hybrid brood grows and prospers. Gene stealer broods are usually only successful once a breeding community of wild orcs has been infected. If a civilized community is infected, it has a catalytic effect on the orc breeding urge, due to the influence of the gene stealer gene. And orc hybrids occur eventually, but usually the gene stealer incursion simply dies out. It is very rare for the brood to survive long enough for pure strains to emerge, and then there are few. This is because the orc life cycle simply does not favor the propagation of a gene stealer brood. Orcs do not breed until the end of their lives, and so the development of a brood is very slow. Also, hybrid whelps are unlikely to be adopted by the civilized orcs. A patriarch who realizes his mistake will tend to use the orc brood as a temporary stage in making contact with more suitable hosts. A little interesting tidbit about the interplay between orcs and gene stealers. Also, Games Workshop, if you're listening and you need an idea for a unit to add to 40k, Gene Stealer Orc Hybrids, great, you get to update the Orc range and the Tyranid range at the same time, do it. That's going to wrap up our look at Rogue Trader. Now let's travel through time and enter 2nd Edition. 2nd Edition is going to feel so streamlined in comparison to the things that we have just explored. 2nd Edition brought with it the Codex Tyranids. This was the real beginning of the modern Tyranid forces that we see today, though the models looked nothing like the current range of models. Personally, I love the old 2nd Ed Tyranids. They have a real ultra-alien feel to them that even the Tyranids of the modern era struggle with a little bit. There is some real weirdness in this codex, there is some real wackiness, and it makes a lot of sense that the Gene Stealers ended up here. The first thing we're going to do is take a look at how the Gene Stealers lore has expanded since those early days. This is going to read a lot more familiar, I think, to a lot of our listeners. The Imperium first encountered Gene Stealers on the moons of Imgarl long before they were alerted to the approach of the Hive Fleets. At the time, it was assumed that Imgarl Gene Stealers were an indigenous life form, so no active Xenocide campaign was undertaken against these deadly alien creatures. Gene Stealers were discovered in a number of out-of-the-way locations over the following decades, including aboard an increasing number of drifting space hulks. The Adeptus Astartes eliminated several Gene Stealer outbreaks, but were forced to vaporize some of the most heavily infested hulks. The Inquisition began investigating the spread of Gene Stealers, and censored Imperial shipping cartels for their lax security. No firm connection was made between the Gene Stealers and the Tyranids, until Gene Stealers were reported amongst the forces of Hive Fleet Behemoth at the Battle of Macragge. There, the Gene Stealers attacked in unstoppable waves,
time and time again overwhelming the defenders with their sheer speed and ferocity. As extended investigation by the Inquisition has since made it clear that the Gene Stealers are the Tyranids' vanguard, shock troops and guerrilla fighters, sent ahead of the Hive fleets to scout out and infiltrate the enemy. Gene Stealers possess the six-limbed body form of all Tyranid creatures, with powerful ripping claws and taloned hands. They are incredibly fast and dangerous opponents in hand-to-hand combat, but never used ranged weaponry or other devices, despite their obvious intelligence. Gene Stealers can operate independently of the Hive Mind, having a gestalt brood intelligence of their own. Gene Stealers appear to be an important part of the fighting forces of the Hive Fleets, where their speed and power make them devastating shock troops. More insidiously, they are implanted aboard drifting space hulks encountered by the Hive Fleet in the warp. By this means, they are allowed to spread ahead of the Tyranid Hive Fleet, prepare the way for planetary invasion, and discover the richest sources of genetic material. It seems unlikely that such monsters could conceal themselves from humans for long, but by lurking aboard space hulks, the Gene Stealers are able to ensnare and infect explorers that come aboard by implanting them with their genetic material. Once infected, a victim can be controlled by the psychic brood intelligence of the Gene Stealers, and becomes completely dedicated to their cause. The implanted germ cell grows inside its host until it is ready to emerge. The Gene Stealers' genetic attributes are passed on, in part, to the offspring, creating monstrous Stealer hybrids, whose own spawn will either be pure strain Gene Stealers, or more human-seeming hybrids. As the hybrid brood grows in strength, it generates a psychic signal that the Hive Fleets can follow, drawing the Tyranids on to rich feeding grounds. Here we see a much more modern take on Gene Stealers. Gone are a lot of the references from the early days, which is a bit of a shame. They have lost a lot of their wackiness and weirdness, but this is a more streamlined view of these aliens, and they have to work within the greater Tyranid whole. And I think this lore strikes a good compromise between that very early lore and working them into this bigger army. Gene Stealers remain terrifying in second edition. I think this might be their absolute peak of pure killing power. A Gene Stealer is movement 6, weapon skill 7, ballistic skill 0, strength 6, toughness 4, 1 wound, initiative 7, 4 attacks, and leadership 10. They have the special rules immune to psychology, chitinous armor, which gives them a saving throw of 5 or 6, and they cause fear, because they're spooky. In 2nd edition, Gene Stealers are taken in broods of 6 to 12. They are armed with their claws, and they have no other war gear. They are 28 points per model. Gene Stealers are incredibly deadly in close combat. The only perceived downside might be that they are just armed with basic claws. However, in 2nd edition, your strength modified your opponent's armor save, so they would hit at strength 6 with negative 3 to their opponent's armor save, making them extremely deadly to anything that's not in Terminator armor. Also, with a weapon skill of 7, 6 strength, and 4 attacks, these guys have a close combat ability that rivals the heroes of other units. Their weapon skill matches the best weapon skill you can get on a Space Marine commander. Their strength 6 beats that Space Marine commander's strength of 5. And this for 28 points per model. Regular tactical marines in this edition start at around 27 points per model, so you're really not even paying all that much for this incredible ability. The real weakness of the Gene Stealer comes in his general lack of survivability. He has toughness 4 with a 5-up armor save and just a single wound. This means that bolters will readily put down Gene Stealers. However, should a Gene Stealer get into close combat with whoever is firing that bolter, or just anything at all, it will rip them to pieces. That includes good assault units like Khorne Berserkers and Death Company Marines, neither of which really hold a candle to a Gene Stealer. About the only thing they can't deal with very well is vehicles in this edition. The second edition Tyranid book
gave us not only rules for our regular Tyranid army, but also rules for the Gene Stealer cults. This is a very streamlined list compared to the ones that we looked at earlier, but it's still nice to see it included here. These alternate lists were more common in second edition. Another book that has good alternate lists is the Chaos Codex from that era, one that I rate quite highly, and I love the fact that we got an alternate list in this book as well. Now let's see a few of the differences between this and the Rogue Trader era. You are still led by a Gene Stealer Patriarch. The Patriarch is still very nasty in close combat. He has psychic powers. He is a very scary general to meet in close combat. Not a lot in the way of defense, unfortunately. The Gene Stealer Patriarch also has a psychic mastery level of 4, which is pretty incredible for a 72-point model. Another character is the Gene Stealer Magus. This is your human psyker hybrid, and he is pretty darn good. The Gene Stealer Magus, like the Patriarch, also has a psychic mastery of 4. You can do some pretty insane things with psychic powers in the Gene Stealer cult army. The cult icon bearer. And he's just a little hero character that does what a battle standard bearer does in Warhammer Fantasy, in that any cult broods within 12 of the icon bearer may reroll the dice if they fail a break test. The last of the characters is the Gene Stealer hybrid. There are two to choose from, the Neophyte and the Acolyte, and they are basically champion models for your broods, which is really interesting. You can also make them into mini psychers, upgrading to Psychic Mastery 1 at 25 points or Psychic Mastery 2 at 50 points, and that's just for the Acolyte. However, the Neophyte is a little bit stronger in close combat. Depending on how you want to build them, they have a lot of utility, and that kind of reminds me of how Hero Hammer works with champions being characters instead of being unit upgrades. Now we move on to broods. Our first brood is the Gene Stealer brood, which are exactly the same Gene Stealers as in the main codex. Then we get the Gene Stealer hybrid brood. So these are whole units of Neophytes and Acolytes, which is really interesting. However, the only way you can get that Acolyte that is a Psyker is by taking it from the character list. Then we have squads of Brood Brothers. The Brood Brothers are humans that are implanted by Gene Stealers. So these guys are just straight up humans, but they've been implanted and they are mind controlled. And that does it for broods. Again, this list is quite toned down. It's been quite streamlined and simplified since Rogue Trader. You do have some interesting choices for support, however. The first thing it tells us is that you can get allies. And where can you get allies from for your Gene Stealer cult? You can get them from the Warhammer 40k Chaos Army list. Isn't that a fun little throwback? I'm sure they did that for the poor folks who had painstakingly made chaos-worshipping Gene Stealer cults, and I'm so glad that they threw that in there, so you can still get a few of your chaos units in with your broods. The next thing in support is the Brood Brother Heavy Weapons team. This is very much like the Imperial Guard Heavy Weapon team. They can take the things that you would think they could take, las cannons, heavy bolters, autocannons, missile launchers, and mortars, all those fun ones. And they have the stat line of base humans. So again, these guys, just humans being mind controlled by the Gene Stealers, nothing special there. You can grab a Rapier Laser Destroyer if you need some bigger, heavier hitting, which you probably will. Then there is the ever famous Tarantula. There's very few armies of this era that can't get a tarantula some way. Space Marines, Imperial Guard, the Gene Stealer cults. I wouldn't be surprised to even see it in, like, some of the Eldar lists. It's really silly. This thing got everywhere. It is basically a twin-linked weapons platform. You could get las cannons, multi-meltas, missile launchers, autocannons, and heavy bolters for it. Also stolen from the Imperial Armories, we have the Mole Mortar. So very fun unit that uses tunneling torpedoes that burrow under an enemy's position and then explode. And finally, the Thud Guns, also known as quad launchers. And as a last little note, the cult could take vehicles. And it represented the Genestealer cult having liberated these from Imperial forces. And to you power gamers out there, they made sure to tell you that all cult vehicles must be painted in the appropriate cult colors and markings to show their new allegiance. So no just sticking your Ultramarines Predator in this army. You gotta paint some gribbly symbols on it first. But here are the vehicles that you could take. You could take a Land Raider, a Rhino, a Predator, a Leman Russ Battle Tank, a Chimera, a Sentinel, or an Imperial Guard Landspeeder. The war gear list for the Genestealer cults was quite basic. It's everything that you would expect to see in the Imperial Guard book, but a little bit more rustic and a little bit more basic. Some of my favorite weapons include the crossbow and the bow, which you could give to models if you really wanted that feral world feel. All in all, I think the lists in this book do a pretty good job of capturing some of that feel from the Rogue Trader era, but it just doesn't have quite the same flavor, and maybe there was no way to cram as much craziness as we got in Rogue Trader into one of these much more streamlined codexes. I remain a fan of this book, and before we leave it, I want to share with you one of the stories contained within. The scavengers struggled forwards over the debris littering the corridor, their suits' lights barely penetrating the swirl of dust kicked up by their progress. This section of the Space Hulk was a complete wreck. The corridor walls were buckled and twisted, ancient cabling spilled from rents in the ceiling, and the mangled floor plates jutted up at such angles that the group's movement was slowed to a crawl. The men wore a mismatch of patched spacesuits and pieces of armor. Most carried shoulder arms or pistols, but their leader hacked a path forwards with a glowing power sword. The lights picked out a doorway ahead, and the deep shadows within it jerked and leapt as the men struggled towards it. The leader stepped inside the doorway and swept his light around the chamber beyond. Thick riveted pipes obscured the ceiling, but the floor was mostly clear. Man-high, curiously curved objects clustered thickly on the walls at the edge of sight. Snaking tubes or cables seemed to interconnect them and trail away across the floor. The rest of the gang entered and fanned out, covering all parts of the shadowy chamber with their lasguns and autopistols, as their leader moved to examine the objects. At first he could not determine their purpose at all. They glittered in the light like black, shiny seeds. The tubes were of a similar hue, but with a bluish patina, where they spread over the bases of objects and divided into dozens of finer filaments. When he saw that some of them were open, he finally understood, and the hairs rose on the nape of his neck, just as a cold, sick sensation rose in his stomach. He spun around to shout at the rest of the men to run, but it was already too late. Man-like creatures with four clawed arms dropped from the pipes above and ripped into them with impossible speed. Screams and shots echoed around the chamber as the men were torn apart, but none of the black-blue figures fell. In a few heartbeats, the leader stood alone. The creatures stalked closer, their bodies crouched as if ready to spring. Their pallid, bulbous heads and fang-filled maws glittered in the light. The leader flourished his power sword with more confidence than he felt. The blade was instantly knocked from his hand by a blow that was too quick to see, as the creatures darted forward. Powerful claws gripped his limbs, and the man was held helpless as one of the Genestealers leaned closer. The hollow needle of its ovipositor slithered out of its tongue, questing, almost gently, towards the man's face. 1 month later, Free Captain Larnos landed at Graia too, with a most unusual cargo. That's a story I enjoy a whole lot. It's got some real alien vibes to it with the pod capsules and realizing that some of them are open far too late. I think it's interesting just how long Genestealers can spend dormant and waiting for prey species to come upon them. But at least that is consistent with the Tyranid race, which travels through space for seemingly thousands of years at a time in a dormant state as well. We're going to end things off in early third edition today. And the main reason that we're going to stop in here is just to see the marked difference between the early eras and the 3rd to 7th era, and what it meant for gene stealers. The first thing that we lost moving into 3rd edition was gene stealer cults. All of them. From the patriarch right on down to the littlest brood brother, they went, and we wouldn't see them again for decades. Not until 7th edition would we see the gene stealer cults come out of hiding, with a whole new range, a very cool look, although I think they leaned a little too heavily into the mining look for the gene stealer cults. I would have liked to have seen maybe a little bit more diversity in their looks, but I do understand that Games Workshop wants them to look like a coherent force on the table. And they did get some very cool stuff back. Third edition gutted so much from Warhammer 40,000, and a lot of it has never returned. Gene Stealers got hit as hard as pretty much everything else did because they had so much lore and so much importance to that early era of Warhammer 40,000. In the third edition book, and these were the small pamphlet-sized books that came out around the start of 3rd edition. I like to call it the pamphlet hammer era. And as I've mentioned, it was an era I really liked as a kid, but I also started 40k in 3rd edition, so I didn't know how much was lost. The Tyranid Codex of this edition was an interesting beast. It had more options than most of the other pamphlet books combined. You could actually do a lot of really interesting things. There were two types of units in the book. There were mutable genus groups and genafixed species. All of the units that were mutable genus had a bunch of different options that you could take, as well as having altered characteristics. For example, both Gaunts and Tyranid Warriors were mutable genus species, and so you could buy them extra stats. For warriors, extra weapon skill, ballistic skill, strength, initiative, and save, which was a really cool thing. And I'm really sad that it didn't continue on into fourth and subsequent editions of Tyranids, because at the time it was the be-all of make your own army, which Tyranids should really be considering their fluff about how they are always adapting and changing. Sadly, the gene stealers of the era are genofixed, which means you cannot buy them a lot of upgrades, though they do have some options. They are 16 points per model, and for that you get weapon skill 6, ballistic skill 0, strength 4, toughness 4, 1 wound, initiative 6, and 2 attacks, with leadership 10 and a 6 up save. A huge downgrade from 2nd edition, though they do come in at 12 points cheaper. You lose a point of weapon skill, 2 points of strength, 1 point of initiative, 2 attacks, and 1 point of saving throw. And yeah, that is quite a significant drop. You could buy some of that back, however. You could buy Toxin Sacks for plus 1 strength at 6 points, Scything Talons for plus 1 attack at 5 points, and Extended Carapace for plus 1 save at 3 points. And if you were to buy these 3 upgrades, you would end up with a gene stealer that costs 30 points and is still not as good as the 2nd edition stealer, unfortunately. They did have a couple of special rules to help them out in this edition. They had Infiltrate, the classic rule where they could work up into a forward position, a very, very valuable rule for gene stealers, as they are even more fragile if you're not springing for the extended carapace of this edition, which you probably shouldn't with the way that the 3rd to 7th edition worked, with AP5 being the standard. They also had Brood Telepathy, which allowed them to function outside of synapse range, which was necessary since you were always going to be infiltrating them anyway. Gene Stealers certainly weren't bad in this era. I would probably try and take Toxin Sacks if I had the points, just to wound Space Marines on that 3 instead of a 4. Either way, they were quite dangerous, and their claws were upgraded to Rending Claws. I guess it's more of a side grade, because in the 3rd and later era, the strength of the attack was decoupled from the armor penetration value of the attack, which it had been linked in second. And Rending Claws were great because they had a chance to just ignore armor completely. Kind of discount power weapons that only worked some of the time, but certainly not bad. This is the profile that Games Workshop would base their Gene Stealers on going forward. And for my money, it just doesn't quite work for them. They were set up to be one of the most dangerous assault units in the game. In Rogue Trader and in 2nd Edition, they were something that could make Terminators think twice. And I mean, that's kind of the whole plot of Space Hulk. So to see them in the 3rd to 7th era, with basically this profile with a few tweaks, just didn't quite feel right. The modern era has seen Gene Stealers as certainly a good close combat unit, and the addition of a 5-up invulnerable save has been a bit of a help, but the current edition of 40k has simply passed them by in a lot of ways. Two wound Space Marines have made their chosen prey into a pretty good counter to them, unfortunately. And I really hope that whenever we see the 9th edition Tyranids Codex come out, that Gene Stealers return to their long absent place of being one of the most terrifying units in 40k. Unfortunately, I'm not going to hold my breath on that because I feel like modern day Games Workshop would rather make a new unit to be an incredible close combat unit than buff their existing units, and especially one as old as the Gene Stealer. Though I could be wrong, and hopefully I will be, and we will see Gene Stealers zooming across the table for years to come. That's going to wrap up our discussion on the Gene Stealers for today. I hope you've enjoyed the episode, and tune in next week when we will have our great Warhammer Hall of Fame induction episode. I hope you have a great week, and until next time, happy wargaming. Thanks for listening to the War Games Orchard. If you like the show, please consider supporting us on Patreon. Our Patreon is non-tiered, so for as little as a dollar, you gain access to our bonus content. The bonus episode for March will be the Warhammer Hall of Shame, an exploration of the worst units and characters in the history of Warhammer Fantasy. If Patreon's not your thing, please consider giving us a 5-star rating on your podcast platform of choice and sharing this show with friends. If you'd like to keep up with War Games Orchard news or get in touch with us, please follow our Facebook page and join our Facebook community at The Warhammer Orchard. You can also find us at wargamesorchard@gmail.com. They are coming. I feel them scratching inside my mind. Scratching, screaming, roaring. So many, so many voices. They're coming for us, flesh and blood, body and soul.